Thank you all. One of my favorite hymns, and I hope you all can hum along with that melody, because we're going to try it in worship for you to sing before too terribly long. I enjoyed especially Carol's words from the table this morning. That notion that God said he'd do it and then he did it is essentially the essence of this new sermon series. Because my contention is there is often a long time between God saying he'd do it and God did it. How do we live in that in-between time? How do we wait for a word from God? How do we wait to hear what God has to say? How do we listen? How do we live in the meantime? And we're going to turn today to the prophet Jeremiah, the 32nd chapter of... Thank you. Forgot my Bible there. 32nd chapter of Jeremiah. We're going to read verses 6 through 15 if you want to follow along. Jeremiah said, "The word of the Lord came to me. Hanamel, son of Shallum, your uncle, is going to come to you and say, 'Buy my field at Anathoth, because as nearest relative, it is your right and duty to buy it.' Then just as the Lord had said, my cousin Hanamel came to me in the courtyard of the guard and said, 'Buy my field at Anathoth in the territory of Benjamin. Since it is your right to redeem it and possess it, buy it for yourself.' I knew that this was the word of the Lord, so I bought the field at Anathoth from my cousin Hanamel and weighed out for him 17 shekels of silver. I signed and sealed the deed, had it witnessed, and weighed out the silver on the scales. I took the deed of purchase, the sealed copy containing the terms and conditions, as well as the unsealed copy, and I gave this deed to Baruch, son of Neriah, the son of Messiah, in the presence of my cousin Hanamel and of the witnesses who had signed the deed, and of all the Jews sitting in the courtyard of the guard. In their presence I gave Baruch these instructions. This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Take these documents, both the sealed and unsealed copies of the deed of purchase, put them in a clay jar so they will last a long time. For this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says. Houses, fields, and vineyards will again be bought in this land. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God." It might be a bit strange to come to church this morning hoping to hear a word of inspiration, hoping to hear a word of motivation to face tomorrow with strength and purpose, hoping to hear a word of encouragement that with God's help you can make it through another week in this dog-eat-dog world, to come looking to hear that kind of good news and instead hear that riveting story in painstaking detail about a real estate transaction from 2,600 years ago. I mean, who does not love the nonstop excitement of signing contracts in triplicate in your lawyer's office? We've got the purchase price, 17 shekels of silver. We've got witnesses. We've got terms and conditions. We've got deeds and copies. We've got the 6th century BC equivalent of a safe deposit box. Jeremiah tells his secretary Baruch, put the deed in a clay jar, a pottery jar, and seal it, so it will be around for decades and decades and centuries. This is edge of your seat excitement, folks. You might be asking yourself, and you would be wise to ask yourself, what does this real estate deal have to do with anything in my life now? Perhaps, what does Jeremiah buying a worthless field in 588 BC have to do with my faith or with my church or my relationship with God? And if you're unfamiliar with this story from Jeremiah 32, these are all very good questions to ask. And we're going to try our best to answer them this morning. First, a couple of reminders about what makes a good real estate deal. I say this not as a realtor. I know there's some of you in the room or brokers, investors. I am simply a guy who has bought a few houses, sold a few houses, and been burned a couple of times along the way. I'm a big fan of reading to my children the Berenstain Bears books. Do you remember the Berenstain Bears books where Papa Bear always shows the kids what to do by doing the wrong thing? I am excellent at that and follow his model quite well. Most of you probably know the well-known adage that the most important thing in real estate is location, location, location. Probably my favorite house that I've lived in outside of the one we live in now is when I lived in Wilson, North Carolina. I got this great house, got a wonderful deal on this house, had a huge den and this big fireplace, and had a detached shed, work building in the backyard that I used as a man cave before anybody called things man caves. I was ahead of the curve, had this man cave, had this great house. It was wonderful until I discovered it was in the worst neighborhood in Wilson. We would hear gunshots every so often, and I wondered why I got such a good deal on that one. Well, location is the most important thing, but timing is important too. And when we sold that house and moved to Georgia, it was in the summer of 2007. If you bought a house in the summer of 2007, you know what a lousy deal you probably got. That was the peak of the housing bubble, and it burst about 3 months after we closed on this house. We put in a fence, and we finished the basement, and did all this work for the house, and still lost money when we sold it to move here. Location and timing. That's what's important in a real estate deal. And Jeremiah has both things going against him in this story. Let's get into the background a little bit. It's 588 BC. We're in Jerusalem, and the kingdom of Judah, the southern kingdom. Jeremiah is a prophet here. And if you read the first 31 chapters of Jeremiah, you will see what it is a prophet does. Now, we kind of think prophecy, and we think about Madam Wanda on the side of the road reading your palm and telling you what the future is going to be. In the biblical world, a prophet is not one who sees into the future, but one who tells the truth, and more often tells the truth to power. And so a prophet's job is not so much to say, this is what's going to happen in the future, because instead it's about saying, you know, you're doing X, you need to stop doing X, because if you don't stop doing X, then Y is going to happen. If you're a parent, you have these conversations, you know. Kids, if you keep riding the dog, something bad is going to happen. If you keep jumping on the trampoline with your BB gun, something bad is going to happen. It doesn't take supernatural abilities to see that future. You're talking about the future because what you're doing is calling out and telling the truth in the present. And so in 588 BC, Jeremiah is in Jerusalem. The king is a man named Zedekiah. And Jeremiah has been doing a prophet's job, which is telling the truth to power, telling Zedekiah what's going to happen. And as you can imagine, Zedekiah, as a king, does not particularly care to hear the truth. And the truth is that Jeremiah keeps telling him, because of your lack of faith, because of the ways that you have been living, God's judgment is coming. And what that looks like is Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army are going to come into town, and they're going to take over, and they're going to send you into exile. So you need to change your ways and get ready. Well, Jeremiah keeps saying this and keeps saying this and keeps saying this, and Zedekiah uses his king's privilege and throws Jeremiah in jail. Jeremiah is jailed for treason for saying all of these things. That's where the story takes place that we read today. Jeremiah is sitting in a prison cell, and King Nebuchadnezzar, just as Jeremiah said, has his army at the gates of the city, getting ready to overtake the city, getting ready to take things over and ship everybody off in exile. And if you read those first 31 chapters of Jeremiah, you will learn that Jeremiah is not one to hold back. You know, it's easy for that young lady to guess that Jesus' first words out of the tomb were, ta-da. We might could guess that Jeremiah's first words when the king comes into town, or when King Nebuchadnezzar comes into town with his army, is, told you so. But it's not. What Jeremiah does, instead of going to Zedekiah and say, see, told you so, everything that I said would happen is happening. Instead, Jeremiah says, I need to talk to my cousin Hannah. Here's what happens. Instead of talking to the king, he talks to Hanamel, who happens to be trying to sell a field that he owns in their hometown of Anathoth. He's got a field that he wants to sell in Anathoth, and there's good reason he wants to sell the field, because the Babylonian army is at the gate, and he'd like to get a little money out of this deal before Nebuchadnezzar takes over the land for himself. And so Hanamel comes to Jeremiah, their cousins, and says, you know, there's a Jewish custom at this time that family has the right to buy back family land before anybody else. So Hanamel comes to his cousin Jeremiah and says, don't you want to buy this piece of land? Wouldn't you like to keep this land in the family? Wouldn't it be nice to keep this land in the family? And surprisingly, Jeremiah says, yes, I'll buy the field. And then what I read you a few minutes ago was a long description of that real estate transaction. Jeremiah buys that plot of family land. Where is it? In occupied territory. When does he buy it? While he's in jail, and the Babylonian armies are storming the city. Location and time. Location and time. Neither one is on Jeremiah's side. According to every possible way you can think of to measure this, it's a crummy deal. It's one of those where you can imagine Hanamel saying, you know, let's skip the appraisal and the inspection, and let's do closing now. Can we do closing now? Let's get your pen on the contract here. It's a crummy deal every way you measure it, but Jeremiah goes through with the deal. Jeremiah goes through with the deal. Make sure it goes by the book. Make sure the records would survive. All because of what I read in verse 15. The Lord said, houses and fields and vineyards will again be bought in this land. Jeremiah's in jail. The king is on the way out. The lands are being occupied by an invading army. Looking through the lens of history, we know that not only will the city fall, not only will the king and all the other leaders be exiled for decades, the temple will be destroyed. But Jeremiah buys a field because God says there's more to the story. God says there's more than just what you can see right now. God says, I'm not done with this place, and I'm not done with these people. The Christian Century is a magazine that was actually started by disciples in Chicago many years ago. It's an ecumenical religious magazine now. And a few years ago, they did a series where they asked a number of theologians and preachers and academics and writers to say, what's the gospel in seven words? Can you boil down the gospel to seven words or less? Martin Marty said, God through Jesus Christ welcomes you anyhow. Like that one. Somebody else said, in Christ, God's yes defeats our no. Another quoted the golden rule, love your neighbor as yourself. Another only needed four words, we live by grace. I like all of those, but had they asked me, they didn't ask me. But had they asked me, I'm not bitter about it. Had they asked me, I would have said this. Tomorrow does not depend upon today. Tomorrow does not depend upon today. To me, that's the story that the Bible tells over and over and over and over again. Tomorrow doesn't depend upon today. Sitting under the oaks of Mamre, Sarah and Abraham had absolutely no reason to believe they would ever have a child until they did. Enslaved in Egypt, the Israelites had no reason to ever believe they would be free until they were. After the cross, the followers of Jesus had no reason to believe they would ever see him again until there he is in their midst, being made known in the breaking of bread. Tomorrow does not depend upon today. There has never, ever been a real good reason to believe in God's promises. We can't point to any evidence. There's nothing demonstrable that we can prove about it. We can't discern it from our present circumstances, except that over and over and over and over again, God keeps his promises. With God, tomorrow doesn't depend on today. That's why we enter the waters of baptism. That's why we gather around this table and break bread and drink the cup. That's why we can stand in a graveyard and say with Paul, where, O death, is your victory? Where is your sting? That's why Jeremiah can buy a fairly worthless piece of land from a prison cell as Nebuchadnezzar's army bears down upon the city. The cover of our bulletin today has a image that is familiar to you if you own an iPhone or an iPad. It is an icon that comes up when you're texting. And if you have texted somebody else and you're waiting for them to text you back, you get that little image on your screen, that dot, 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 that ellipsis that says they're typing. That a message is coming. That the conversation is still going, even if you can't see it yet. That the other person has something to say, even though you haven't heard it yet. I kind of like the theology of that symbol. I kind of like the power of that symbol as a reminder that God is speaking even when we can't hear Him. That more is coming even when we can't see it yet. That the story isn't over even when it feels like it is. You know, it seems crazy when Jeremiah buys that field, but you know what? It isn't any crazier than showing up here this morning. It's what I've always liked Peter Gomes' definition of a Christian. To be a Christian is to be a changed person in an unchanged world. To be a Christian is to be a changed person in an unchanged world. To live between God's promise, I'm going to do it, and when God says, it's done. To live in that between, trusting that God is going to come through. Trusting that God is going to do what God has done so many times before. Tomorrow doesn't depend upon today. God is still speaking. God is still moving. God is still working, and the story isn't over yet. This week, as I've been thinking about Jeremiah, I keep thinking back to several years ago. We were in our house in Georgia that we paid too much for. And I was getting ready to go to work one morning, and I needed something. I don't remember what it was. But I went into the spare bedroom, opened up the closet, was looking for it in there, and hanging up in the closet was a cute little dress for a baby girl. Now, you might not think much about that, except that this was long before our daughter Riley was in the picture. This was several years before Riley was in the picture. This was several years before we had talked about Riley. And there was a baby girl's dress in the closet, and I took it out and took it to my wife Leanne and said, honey, is there something we need to talk about? And she said, no, nothing. What's the deal with the dress? Why do we have clothes for a little girl? Well, we're going to have one day. When? I don't know. Now, it might make a really good story if I told you that I was blown away by my wife's faithfulness and, you know, was convinced that this was the right thing. I thought she was crazy. I thought she was nuts. And by absolutely every measure that the world figures it, she was. But she knew what I did. The story isn't over yet. The story isn't over yet. So go buy a dress. Go buy a field. Go live as if God's promises are true. Because if you do, you will learn they are. Every last one. Thanks be to God. Amen.